Well, what happened? What happened to men and women? What happened to fathers and mothers? And what happened to marriage and the family? Please turn with me to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. Verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and all the earth, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And so mankind was created in the image and in the likeness of God. And as it says here, God created him, or mankind, both male and female. In other words, one essential creation with two separate components, neither one being whole or complete in and of themselves, but together making the perfect complementary package, male and female. This was God's intent from the beginning, and the genders were a very important element of God's creation, as we shall see as we go through this series of sermons. Mankind has taken upon themselves the decisions to change some of these conditions and circumstances, to resist God's directive, and to create themselves in their own image after images and ideas and concepts that they would prefer over those that God ordained. Also, of course, we read in verse 27, God created man in his own image, and in the image of God, male and female, as I said. Then verse 28, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And of course, after that was completed, his creation had finished at the end of the sixth day, God looked at what he had done and he said, "It was very good." But as I mentioned earlier, man seems to have a different opinion regarding some of the things and the concepts and the essentials of maleness and femaleness, husbands and wives and families. There seems to be a disagreement and a concern over whether or not God got it right. And so our society and culture has taken upon itself to make some rather radical changes and change some of the things that God put in place from the beginning. And that's what I would like to discuss in this upcoming series of sermons on biblical manhood and biblical womanhood. And this is the first in the series, and today I would like to lay the groundwork for the discussion. And first of all, as I'm turning here in the book of Genesis to these fundamental verses, I'd like to make some observations about God's creation of mankind, male and female, and see what information we can draw, what clues there are in the creation account that might help us understand our roles, our gender-specific characteristics as men and women, males and females, which ultimately become mothers and fathers, members of a family, two parties that become one in marriage. All of this designed by God from the beginning, and I think we'll see that there are a number of clues here that will help us and guide us as we try to discover the essence of biblical manhood and biblical womanhood. What was God's intent from the beginning? And I will, of course, give a disclaimer here as I go through this information. Please stay with me through all four of the sermons. Do not become frustrated or discouraged if I cannot cover everything in the first sermon. If you hear something that sounds like, well, he is obviously a chauvinist and he's retreating back to the old days. If I am going to retreat back to any old day, it's going to be the creation account and not the old days when men were not really as kind or considerate as they should have been, when women were not as they should have been. So we all have a lot to learn, and I don't want you to miss important factors here because of something that I might say that might raise your suspicion a little bit. Please bear with me as I try to describe from the Scripture some of the principles that will guide us as we begin to discover what God intended men to be like and what God intended women to be like. So let's begin by trying to gather some clues from the creation. Turn with me to 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2. And we will discuss this further, but I want to show that this was, in fact, something God had in mind when he created Adam first. There was an order of creation. And I'm suggesting to you that God had something in mind when he did so. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, we read in verse 13, "For Adam was formed first, then Eve." Adam was formed first, then Eve. And I think we will see that God had an intended purpose, and we will try to clarify that and bring that out in the weeks ahead. Second of all, Adam named all the creatures, apparently before Eve was created. Adam named all the creatures before Eve was created. Now, this reflects the intellectual capacity of Adam and Eve. They were not born, you might say, yesterday, even though they were, in a sense, because they were created and obviously were adults from the get-go, as we would say in Texas. So as a result, it is rather amazing after such a short period of time on the earth that Adam had a catalog and a backlog, you might say, of information that allowed him to name all the animals as God had them march past Adam. What a wonderful thing that would be. Going to a petting zoo is one thing, but this must have been a marvelous experience. If you love animals, you would love it. If you don't like animals, you probably wouldn't. You'd rather not stand in line and see all the different animals. But Adam named them all. And what was the obvious conclusion he drew at the end of it? Every one of them had a mate suitable to themselves, a complement to them. And when Adam got done naming all the animals, it became obvious. Well, he looked around and, where's my complement? Where's the other one, you might say, that looks like me? And in the Hebrew, man, the word man, is ish, which probably most ladies really kind of like. It's because we are ishy sometimes. But get this, the Hebrew word for woman is what? Isha. So it's ish and isha, both the same root. And I think that was an important factor as well, because the two are to become one, husband and wife, in that particular relationship. I want you to notice something else. And I pose this as a question, and I really suspect that this is the case, but I don't know that you can prove it from the context of the book of Genesis in these early chapters. Did God give the instructions regarding the tree of the knowledge of good and evil to Adam only prior to Eve's creation? That can be drawn from the context of the Genesis account. I'm not saying that it did happen, but I'm wondering if it did. And I tend to believe it very well may have. And then he was expected by God to convey this instruction to his wife because of his God-ordained role as the leader of his home and his family. Is that the case? Notice in Genesis chapter 2, verse 16. Just take a look here. I don't wish to make a dogmatic statement here. But notice in verse 16, the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat." And even if Eve was there, you might say, he's directing his discussion and his comment to Adam. "But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." And the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." So it would appear that in the context of these verses, the creation of Eve was not yet accomplished. But then you can go back to where we just left off in Genesis 1, and you can read that he created them male and female. How close together was it, and what intervening events occurred? I'm not absolutely sure, but I am suggesting that there's a good possibility that God did give these directions to Adam and that he was expected to convey them to Eve. And if you'll notice, another interesting point that's always puzzled me. In Genesis 3, Eve added one other restriction that you don't read about in God's directive. She told the serpent, the snake, that they were not even allowed to touch this tree or the fruit of it. Well, the problem was eating it, not necessarily touching it. So I wonder if Eve added a little something based on what Adam told her. And it sounds even more restrictive, doesn't it? And you can just see the wheels turning and Satan being successful in tempting her to disobey God, because after all, that seems very restrictive. I mean, we can't even touch this tree. What's so great about this? What's different about this tree? And you can just see how human reasoning just creates this whole series of events that suddenly makes it a very smart thing to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, no matter what God said, because human nature can make those compromises rather rapidly. Now, I want you also, in the context of clues from creation, as we discuss biblical manhood and womanhood, to note that Adam was called into account first, after the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was looked at, considered, the fruit was taken. Eve took a bite, passed it off to Adam. He took of the fruit of the tree. And then, of course, the next event that occurred in the Genesis account, God calls and asks, "Where are you?" And he was calling for Adam. And so he said, "I heard your voice in the garden," verse 10, "and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself." Why didn't he call for Eve? Was not Eve the one who the serpent approached first? Of course she was. But did God, by that act and by that event, hold Adam responsible for what happened? Because he was the leader. He was the place where the buck was supposed to stop. And also, I would note something regarding Eve, in that she was apparently very close to the forbidden tree when the serpent approached her. Because she could look at it, she could see it. It wasn't just a visual thing in her mind that she was dreaming about. She was right there by the tree. She looked at it. She considered it. So what was Eve doing there in the first place? The garden must have been fairly good size. Was she attracted to that tree for some reason? And was she there without her husband? It would appear so. Was she considering this kind of thing even before the snake approached? I don't know. These are all questions. And also, considering our adversary, let me ask you this. Do you think our adversary, Satan the devil, considered which of the two would be more vulnerable when it came to his sales pitch? I suggest that he did. And that there are a couple of elements I'd like to suggest here. First of all, most women understand how vulnerable men are when it comes to following directives and suggestions made by women, to impress a woman, to please a woman, to satisfy a woman, is often a very strong drive that men have. Ask most husbands, if mama isn't happy, nobody's happy. And if mama is happy, everybody's happy. Now, we've all heard that. We all laugh and chuckle at it. But there's at least a mustard seed grain of truth to that. And I don't know how much of this our adversary considered, but I'm suggesting to you without a doubt, he chose which one would be more susceptible and more likely. And he chose Eve. I don't have any doubt that probably either one of them would have succumbed, but as the whole thing played out, it is interesting to note some of these elements of the Genesis account. And of course, my point is that God created them in order. He created them with certain responsibilities and roles that he expected both of them to meet. Now, I'd like to take a look at just a few other elements of the creation before we continue. God created mankind as male and female. Two genders, each with unique yet complementary characteristics of body, mind, and spirit, which when brought together in the bond of marriage, produce a complete package, interlocking pieces of a puzzle, each with their own distinctive characteristics, each incomplete without the other in terms of possessing the parts of the whole that God intended to reflect when he created mankind in his image and after his likeness. It took two genders to fully reflect the magnitude and majesty of God and his personality, if I could even use that term, and the breadth and depth and height of his thoughts and feelings and what made God, God. And making man and woman was essential in reflecting all of the characteristics and traits of God. And he did so, and he did so with a purpose. He also formed Adam from the dust of the ground. He formed Eve from Adam's right side, a rib, if you will. She was to be his companion, his complement. And I suppose he could have created her from Adam's toenail or his head, part of his hair, just the location from the side, a rib, a complement, a helper, someone who goes along beside, a team member, someone very close. And your perfect complement, the mother of their children. You know, their sexual gender differences specifically were designed for reproduction and to unite them as one flesh, joined by God himself with the command to be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. Furthermore, the man was to leave his father and his mother, which was a close-knit, loving family relationship. That was God's intention from the beginning. And be joined to or cleave to his wife, an even closer relationship, and become one with her. Now, all of the above elements help give clarity to the roles our Creator had in mind for each gender. And that's what we want to explore as we continue the series. Now, I want you to note a couple of other elements here before we move into a discussion of the current situation of male and female, man and woman, husband and wife in our 21st century. Here in Genesis chapter 3, verse 16, the consequences of the sin of Adam and Eve are doled out. I want you to notice what happened in verse 16. What did God say to the woman, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, I would suggest here a couple of things. First of all, it would appear that the consequence for Eve's sin was going to be realized and felt in the course of her fulfillment of her God-given role as mother, as the one who bears the children, for in sorrow would she bear them. Her desire would also be to her husband, and he shall rule over you, and that is not necessarily a positive context here. You see, I want to clarify as well that God's intended marriage directives were given before this incident occurred. And there are certain consequences that women, females, and wives in particular have suffered as a consequence of this sin. And the relationship between husbands and wives has rarely been godly down through 6,000 years. We have rarely gotten it right. From women being bought and sold, polygamy, abusive conduct, repression, the old phrase of keep them barefoot and pregnant, that is never what God had in mind. There was never that indication or inclination. And yet, because of the world and culture and society in which we live and Satan's influence in same, this is the consequence, and it hasn't been pretty. It's not been pretty for men either, for men have not fulfilled their role and responsibility as they should, and of course, women have had their difficulties as well. And so the issues here, however, as I pointed out earlier, are related to Eve's primary responsibility and role as a mother, the consequences of her sin, and to Adam, because you have heeded the voice of your wife. Notice how God holds Adam accountable. He began with Eve by simply saying, I will greatly multiply your sorrow. To Adam, he turned and said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife. Now, I hope our husbands don't take this as license. Well, God never wants me to heed the voice of my wife. Look at what trouble Adam got into because he listened. No, that's not the point at all. In fact, husbands would probably be far better off. The world would be far better off if husbands had listened to their wives more frequently. But there's a balance in that, and we would like to discuss that and address that as we go down the road. Now, in continuing, cursed is the ground for your sake. You shall toil to eat of it all the days of your life. There'll be thorns, there'll be thistles, there'll be bugs, there will be bad weather, there'll be tornadoes, there'll be floods. And you'll have to work hard by the sweat of your face to gain your bread. In the Garden of Eden, they could just pluck what they wanted and eat. But now they're going to have to work and sweat and toil. And in the end, you're going to return to the dust you came from. So you see, Adam's role is clarified, you might say, as the breadwinner, as the provider, as the leader of his house. And so it's these simple elements of the creation account that I wanted to bring out as we start our discussion this afternoon and begin this series of sermons. And now I'd like to fast forward to colonial America. And I would briefly like to trace the role of fathers and, of course, to a certain extent, the role of mothers. But I'm going to focus on fathers here as we start this afternoon. And we will progress in talking about both genders because both genders are surely involved in the cultural tectonic shift that is occurring in our lifetimes, and I think we'll see how dramatic the shift is and is becoming as we look at some of the statistical data that I have for you this afternoon. I'll be reading quite a bit of information that I've gathered through research, and I hope you will find it interesting, and I hope it will lay the foundation for our future sermons on this important topic of biblical manhood and biblical womanhood. How did our husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, men and women, get where they are today? Do you remember the old cigarette commercial from years ago? "You've come a long way, baby." And that was quite radical for that period of time. And how many remember Helen Reddy's song? "I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore." And these are some of the milestones of history that I want to bring up as we look at the history of fathers, mothers, men, and women, families in America. I'd like to begin by quoting a number of interesting portions of a book entitled Fatherless America, Fatherless America, by David Blankenhorn. And he gives his opinion about how the digression from fatherhood of the early American colonial period continued to the point that we find it today. Very different. The contrast is shocking. It's amazing. So I'd like to read some excerpts from Mr. Blankenhorn's book. "The fragmentation of fatherhood from the center to the periphery of family life." That's the header he gives for this particular portion of his book. "The fragmentation of fatherhood from the center to the periphery of family life." The periphery meaning the outer bounds, not the center, but the outer rim of the family. "There was a time in America when our cultural story of fatherhood portrayed fathers as essential guarantors of child and societal well-being. In colonial America, fathers were seen as primary and irreplaceable caregivers. According to both law and custom, fathers bore the ultimate responsibility for the care and well-being of their children, especially their older children. Until the early 19th century, in almost all cases of divorce, it was established practice to award the custody of children to fathers. Fathers largely guided the marital choices of their children and directly supervised the entry of children, especially sons, into the world outside the home." And again, I want to remind you, I'm reading one author's perspective on this. This is not to say that it's a balanced perspective, especially in terms of the way fatherhood was viewed and practiced in colonial America. I think we have always had shortcomings as far as fathers and mothers, and there are always things that we can learn. But please do not jump to conclusions as we read some of this information that gives the author's perspective on this topic of the progression of the family, fatherhood and motherhood, maleness and femaleness in our nation. "Most important, fathers assumed primary responsibility for what was seen as the most essential parental task, the religious and moral education of the young." That was the father's responsibility in colonial America. "All of this fundamentally changed," again I'm reading from Mr. Blankenhorn's book, "with the advent of the Industrial Revolution. First, industrialization and the modern economy led to the physical separation of home and work. No longer could fathers be in both places at once," with some few exceptions, of course, but generally speaking, that was the case. The Industrial Revolution took work out of the home and placed it in factories and larger establishments. Businesses began to grow, and our whole economy changed. The engine of our economic development changed during the Industrial Revolution. "No longer, according to Alexander Mishurlik, could children typically acquire skills by watching one's father, working with him, seeing the way he handled things, observing the degree of knowledge and skill he had attained, as well as his limitations." So those days were gone. Now, I grew up in a welding shop with my father. And I learned a lot from him, but as you can see, I didn't turn out to be a welder. But I was right there every day. I was holding things, sweeping things, cleaning things, picking up the tools. I know my father probably better than he knew me at that time, especially because I spent a lot of time with him during his working days. And I was off running around doing who knows what, some of which I've never told him when I was a kid. But that's the way I grew up. Some of you may have grown up that way. But to grow up that way now is not really that frequent or common. It's simply not done anymore to that extent. The 19th century's progressive fragmentation of labor, combined with mass production and complicated administration, the separation of home from the place of work, and the transition from independent producer to paid employee who uses consumer goods led to a progressive loss of substance of the father's authority and a diminution of his power in the family and over the family. This was quoted by Mr. Blankenhorn from a book by William Chafe entitled The Unfinished Journey, America Since World War II. So some of these dramatic shifts and changes in America's economy and in the way fathers and men went to work, he feels, changed the father's relationship to his children and to the mother of his children and to his wife, because he was not at home all the time. He was gone. His children did not watch him work. They watched him leave and they watched him come home. They watched their mother at home. And mother, of necessity, picked up some of the responsibilities in the home that the father had previously undertaken. And so these shifts and changes were taking place already in the 19th century. Remember, that's two centuries ago. We're in the 21st century. A lot has changed in America. The major change in family life in the 19th century was the steady feminization of the domestic sphere and the development of the companionate model of marriage and family, and the sharp contraction of fatherhood as a social role. So the companionate model of marriage brought a new idea to the table that husband and wife, father and mother, were more of a team in raising the children. Before, it had been the primary responsibility of the father, especially geared toward the older children of the household. And he was there. He was the breadwinner on site. He was a standalone breadwinner. A good year on the farm meant we had a lot of food. A bad year on the farm meant we didn't have a lot of food. But he was his own boss. Now, if he worked for a manufacturing concern, he was given a paycheck, not several bushels of corn. And if that money didn't go very far, well, then he had to make other arrangements because he simply wasn't set up to be his own boss and create his own food. It made a tremendous change in the way Americans lived, Americans worked, and how families operated. As the professions of fathers continued to draw them away from home and hearth, mothers tended to take on the roles of chief child raiser, manager, and decision maker. And we're going to see as we go down the road here that this kind of teamwork, this kind of cooperation, and mutually fulfilled roles and responsibilities is a very healthy model and has produced good fruits. It's when roles are reversed or when roles are ignored that problems begin to enter, as we will see. Increasingly, fathers looked outside the home for the meaning of their maleness and found it, to a degree, in individual ambition and achievement in the workplace. The two primary paternal tasks became head of the family and breadwinner. So the fathers retained the head of the family position and the breadwinner responsibility. But much of the rest of their previous duties and responsibilities devolved to the mother. As we shall see, this shift was not all negative in the development of our cultural model of fatherhood. Not all aspects of the agrarian, domineering, patriarchal father were desirable. So we're not saying that. neither is the author. Have we ever achieved the balance of roles and responsibilities described in Scripture? Has the perfect marriage ever been achieved? I think my wife and I have achieved it for maybe a nanosecond, maybe 10 seconds, but then one or the other falls off the edge again, and we have to claw our way back up and ask for forgiveness and go on again. If that's not the way your marriage works, and if you find you found the equation and you have successfully put together the perfect marriage 24/7, come see me. I would like to co-author a book with you and learn your trade secrets. But have we ever, as men and women, husbands and wives, number one, fully understood our roles through 6,000 years? And then, number two, had the strength, the courage, the character, the wisdom, the desire to fulfill those roles and meet God's expectations? Can you imagine what a world we would live in had men and women, husbands and wives, boys and girls, been able to fulfill their God-given roles and responsibilities without the interference of the snake and all that transpired back there in the garden and all that has been transpiring for hundreds, if not thousands of years? The record is abysmal as far as the way men and women have treated one another and the way husbands and wives have treated one another. Have we ever gotten it right? I think in some limited ways we have, but on the other hand, one wonders if we will ever be able to get it right as human beings. It's a high bar, isn't it? Very high. In fact, one of the primary points I would like to make in this series is this. God designed the two genders, male and female, to complement one another. And within the context of His created order, work together to achieve the goals and objectives that God has set before us all as men and women, husbands and wives. However, we were never designed to compete with one another. Never. That was never God's intent. Complement one another, yes. Compete with one another, no. And therein, I believe, lies the primary crux of the problem that we face as the human race. And sadly, I wonder if some of that competitive spirit and some of the attitudes that are out there in the world today have crept into our hearts, into our minds, into our lives, into our marriages and families. It's certainly something to consider. More from Mr. Blankenhorn. In the sum of over 200 years, fatherhood has lost in full or in part each of its four traditional roles: irreplaceable caregiver, moral educator, head of family, and family breadwinner. These four roles have been greatly diminished or removed. Let me read them again. Irreplaceable caregiver. Doesn't sound like the deadbeat dads of today. Remember that phrase? I don't hear it much anymore, but you probably remember hearing it. Is there any excuse for someone not supporting his children? No, there is not. There may be some legitimate reasons that need to be overcome. But in our culture and society, fathers are basically expendable now. You don't need a father to have children, do you? And you don't need a traditional family to raise children anymore, do you? Well, at least according to the laws of the land or what we accept, none of those things are necessary. We're going to see some statistics that bring all of this out in a very graphic and dramatic way. According to Mr. Blankenhorn, marriage and parenting continue to be positively associated with work involvement and rewards for men, but are related to persistent employment disadvantages for women. So men feel as though breadwinning and parenthood are two domains in which they can live and move in concert together. They're not separated. However, with women, with mothers in particular, they view breadwinning and parenthood as conflicting domains. And so they are determined to win the bread, and if they are, in fact, a better breadwinner, and if they can bring home more bread, then let's ask the husband to become the caregiver. And is that wrong for a husband to give care or a father to give care to his children? No. Is it wrong for that particular relationship to be a part of a marriage? Not necessarily. But let's hear the whole thing or the whole matter before we begin to draw conclusions. Here's a Parents Magazine article from June 1994, lauding the new father. The new father celebrates those fathers who put fatherhood before work, recognizing that the workplace may be the staunchest enemy of the involved father, and they use their own fathers as models of what not to do. So the workplace is the enemy of the emotionally connected, sensitive, involved father, because he simply gets too engaged in his work. He's too authoritarian. It gives him too much power and authority. And so at times, if he's really going to be a good father, he has to lose that breadwinning concept, and he has to leave the workplace and come home. This was the new father. And new fathers try not to do what their fathers did. Now, if your father did something wrong, I would, yes, try not to do it. But if your father did some things right, I'd suggest that you try to do them. Makes sense, doesn't it? And yet, we'll see the progression of where this is going. In 1981, the influential sociologist Jesse Bernard offered a seminal critique of the good provider role for fathers. For Bernard, this paternal role delineated relationships within a marriage and family in a way that added to the legal, religious, and other advantages that men had over women. In other words, the traditional role model of the father, the breadwinner, the head of his household, gave the man an unfair advantage. So we're listening to the competitive language again. In fact, it added to the legal, religious, and other advantages that men had over women. Now, why are they advantages? They're only advantages if the man takes advantage of it to the suffering and detriment of his wife and children. Because of it, the wife of a more successful provider became, for all intents and purposes, a parasite. Well, isn't that a wonderful thing? Your husband is a wonderful provider and caregiver for the children, but this author views her as a parasite, just leeching off of the husband and what he brings home. And she has little to do except indulge or pamper herself. Well, I would dare say that I have not met many wives like that. And I've never been married to a wife like that. The good provider role hurt fathers as well, primarily by placing constraints on emotional expressions. Because I'm the boss, I have to act like the boss and the head cheese. And I can't let my emotions down. I can't cry. I can't connect with my children. I can't be a sissy. I have to. So all of these concepts are flowing through this author's rather twisted reasoning. And you can see the progression of advocates who really feel that women have gotten the short end of the stick and now it's time to turn the tables. Similarly, Kathleen Gerson writes, "Breadwinning is a traditional or natural pattern among men, and it is threatening to mothers since it undermines equal parenting and serves as justification for male control over women and children." Now, did God design men to control women and children? Is that the right word? Is leadership always control? Is love control? Are rules controlling? I would hope so. Aren't you grateful for the laws that govern traffic? I was all the way up here. And yet, when you read this kind of thing, it's easy to get drawn into some of this. The concept being driven home, breadwinning thwarts fatherhood. The two are mutually exclusive. You can't be a good breadwinner and a good father. They have to be one or the other. And, of course, we'd rather you not be the breadwinner. We'd rather you take care of the children so we could be. This is the sum total of some women's perspective on raising children and connecting with their children's father. The phenomenon of the working woman entering the job market and the exciting and stimulating world of competing with men for equal pay and equal promotions is a relatively modern tenet of our economic situation, isn't it? Whereas the stay-at-home, non-working, parasitic mother, unemployed, fulfilling the mundane tasks of changing diapers, molding and shaping minds and characters, mopping floors. Well, what fun is that? Let's jump out there into the competitive job market and let's compete with men on their own turf. Here is an article by Sabrina Tavernis, published May 26, 2011. Married couples have dropped below half of all American households for the first time. For the very first time, married couples are less than half of American households. A milestone in the evolution of the American family toward less traditional forms. You see, many will view what we're going to talk about in this series as the evolution of the American family. And what is evolution? The survival of the fittest, everything constantly in a state of improvement, right? That's how we evolved. That's how birds discovered they needed hollow bones in order to fly. And so, I don't know, what did they drill them out the first few times and put them back in? Hollow bones, single organs, all of the miraculous things that we see around us in creation are a product of evolution, blind chance, if you will. Natural selection. Well, are we evolving toward a better American family model, or are we devolving and going down? Well, let's withhold judgment on that. Let's hear more of the facts. Married couples represented just 48% of American households in 2010, according to data being made public Thursday by the Brookings Institution. This was slightly less than in 2000. But far below the 78% of households occupied by married couples in 1950. We have gone from 78% 1950 to 48% in 2010. That is a remarkable statistic. In addition, just 20% of those households were traditional families. Married couples with children, just 20% of that 48%, one-fifth, are traditional families, married couples with children. That figure is down from 43% in 1950, from 43 to 20. As the author continues, as the iconic image, what's an icon? Well, it's something that's outdated and outmoded. It's an Edsel. It's Elvis Presley. It's an icon. It's in the past. We don't need it anymore. So goes the iconic image of the American family, which continues to break apart. And it's a good thing, by some people's estimate. In recent history, the marriage rate among Americans was at its highest in the 1950s, when the institution defined gender roles, family life, and a person's place in society. But as women moved into the workforce, cohabitation lost its taboo label, and as society grew more secular, marriage lost some of its central authority and most all of its sanctity. The days of Ozzy and Harriet have faded into the past. How many of you remember Ozzy and Harriet? Some do and some don't. The quintessential American television family. In fact, they were even on radio, weren't they, for a while, and then Leave It to Beaver and some of the other Father Knows Best. Can you imagine a program entitled Father Knows Best making it in today's entertainment world? That would be hard to imagine. Perhaps better phrased, what does Father know? Fathers aren't too positively portrayed in many cases in our modern society. Today, traditional patterns have been turned upside down. Women with college degrees are now more likely to marry than those with just high school diplomas. The reverse of several decades ago, said June Carbone, a law professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Red Families versus Blue Families. And that is something you will see as you look at these stats on marriage. Younger women without college degrees are marrying earlier, and their marriages are breaking up. Women with college degrees are entering the workforce, securing a career, marrying at a later age, and their marriages seem to be holding together. And their model for relating to each other as male and female husband and wife is dramatically different from the other group I mentioned as well. Rising income inequality has divided American society, making college-educated people less likely to marry those without college degrees. Members of that educated group have struck a new path. They marry later and stay married. In contrast, women with only a high school diploma are increasingly opting not to marry the fathers of their children, whose fortunes have declined along with the country's economic opportunities. And why should you marry the father of your children if you don't love him and he's unemployed? You have a hard enough time supporting yourself and your kid, much less your husband. And that's just that's the undeniable logic of the situation. But how did we get here? How did we get here? Not to justify a father slash husband who can't work, or I shouldn't say won't work. There's a difference. But all of these are quite perplexing elements that we need to put in the mix. William Bradford Wilcox, the director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia, argues that the retreat from marriage is bad for society because it means less security for children. It's troubling because those kids are much more likely to be exposed to instability, complex family relations, and poverty, he said. And the toll of divorce is staggering on children, especially the economic toll. When they are forced to move out of the home that they were nurtured in and loved and brought up in, when mom and dad are separate, perhaps one of them isn't working, the dad can't provide the child support, they have to move out to a less expensive form of housing, they have to sell both cars and buy an old junker. Many adjustments have to be made. And it's a very discouraging picture. And yet that's the reality of many people's lives right now. Continuing, there are 37 states plus the District of Columbia in which married couples make up fewer than 50% of all households. The biggest change for the decade was the jump in households headed by women without husbands, up by 18% in the decade. The next largest rise was in households whose occupants were not a family, up by 16%. So you see, families are disappearing, the traditional family. From a report entitled Women and the Economy, 2012, released August 2010, this was a prediction of where things would go. Here's a quote. The number of women in the workforce has grown by 44.2% over the last 25 years, from 46 million in 1984 to 66 million in 2009. So women have come into the workforce by the millions. And with economic stresses on the overall health of our nation and unemployment numbers rising, more women getting college degrees, more women employed, fewer men employed, and the whole situation just seems to have bubbled and boiled and brewed until we find ourselves in a very difficult dilemma. Now, what is the answer? Is the answer sending all women home and giving their jobs to unemployed men? I don't think that's going to work, do you? But how did we get here? Did we take some turns? Did we make some assumptions? Did we believe some lies as a nation, as humanity, as men and women, as husbands and wives? What is the fruit? Many of you remember the famous sitcom, I Love Lucy. How many remember I Love Lucy? Now, in one of their more memorable programs, you might remember this one, Ricky and Lucy, Fred and Ethel, were the two couples. You remember that? Well, it was to the point where the ladies, Lucy and Ethel, thought that, you know, bringing home the bacon wasn't going to be a real big deal, that about anybody could do that. And Fred and Ricky thought that, yeah, well, being a homemaker, what's the big deal about that? You're home all day, you know, probably eating bonbons and just waiting for us to come home and give you all our... In other words, it was the classic role reversal. They decided to trade roles for a day. So Ricky and Fred put on aprons and they tried to make dinner. And, of course, the whole scene was chaos. The pie was exploding. The kitchen was a disaster area. All the food was burnt. Everything was just a disaster at the end of the day. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Lucy and Ethel got a job in a candy factory. And they were on the bonbon line, the chocolate-covered bonbons. Any of you remember this episode? All right. The assembly line was really moving fast, and they could not keep up with the bonbon production. And so they started stuffing bonbons in their garments and wherever they could stuff them to avoid the ire of the employer. And, well, suffice it to say that their outing into the breadwinning field and undertaking was disastrous as well. So when the two couples united at the end of the day, guess what? They said, well, you know, my day was a disaster, so was ours. Let's go back to the way it was. Let's go back to the way it was. Now, I want to make it clear, I'm not advocating going back to anything that was abusive or inappropriate or ungodly. And I don't think we can go back, can we? Not until Christ returns and shows us what we are to go back to. Go back to the Genesis 1 and 2, not to 3, where we had our falling out, our sin, but go back to what God originally designed marriage and family and men and women and husbands and wives to be. That would be the ideal. But can we go back there? Here is a quote from a recently published book. If you're like me, I didn't think I would live to see the day I would pick up a book by this title, much less purchase it. The book is entitled The End of Men and the Rise of Women. The End of Men and the Rise of Women. This is not a humorous book. This is not some kind of comedic routine. This woman actually believes in the title of the book. And if current trends continue, I think she may very well be a prophetess. And again, it's the whole competitive concept that we mentioned earlier in spades. Here is her rendition of how the I Love Lucy show that I briefly described to you would be played out in our modern 21st century. Barely two generations later, this is Hannah Rosen from the book The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Two generations later, two generations after I Love Lucy, the housewife is a rare breed on American television, unless, of course, you consider Desperate Housewives. And they hardly fill the bill, it would seem. There are hardly any real housewives anywhere who would be caught dead in a flowered apron that wasn't part of a kinky maid's costume. During the intervening years, the real-life Lucys and Rickys sat down at the American kitchen table, and Lucy laid down the new rules. At this point, Lucy was working perhaps as a headhunter or publicist or a Hollywood agent. Ricky, meanwhile, was still nurturing his creative pursuits. Remember, Ricky was the entertainer, and he performed in his own club, etc. So Ricky was nurturing his creative pursuits. Lucy was employed, and she sat him down at the table and laid out the way it was going to be. Lucy was bringing home at least as much money as Ricky and some years more. Lucy was a woman reborn, hiring and firing, getting promotions, then coming home to put little Ricky to bed. That's their child. Big Ricky was helping out too, picking up from daycare every once in a while or making a playground run on a Saturday morning so Lucy could go to a spin class. And by now he'd learned to roast a chicken. Wasn't that something? Remember in the old episode, he couldn't cook. But Lucy, attuned to the cadences of her own satisfaction, wanted still more. And whenever you and I allow our own selfish desires and wants to supersede our obligations and responsibilities, we are going to be in trouble. And the consequences are going to be severe. How many remember My Fair Lady by Lerner and Lowe? The musical rendition of the play Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw. Well, in My Fair Lady, remember Professor Higgins? Why can't a woman be more like a man? That was his lament. Well, that is almost the slogan for many modern feminists. Here is really a shocking article entitled, Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man?, written by Jeffrey P. Hunt. This was taken from the American Thinker website, written March 25, 2012. Initially, feminists demanded independence and equality in the pursuit of intellectual status and economic power. More recently, the feminist agenda has championed the sexual revolution, mainstreaming promiscuity as equal opportunity for women. Why should men enjoy indiscriminate sex with impunity while women are unfairly oppressed and shackled to the realities of reproductive biology and its consequences? In other words, the possibility of a pregnancy. You know, men have no obligation or responsibility, quote unquote. If pregnancy occurs, it's the woman's problem. So how do we address that? Well, we eliminate it as much as we can. And, of course, the joy of indiscriminate sex is now a part of every progressive woman's lifestyle. And I won't take the time to describe it. It's outrageous. It's appalling. You can do the research yourself. What goes on college campuses and among young people today is quite different than what went on in the 50s and 60s in this country, suffice it to say. Feminism and liberal progressivism have descended from aspirational socio-eco-politics, having secured suffrage and economic equality, into self-loathing rage against the tyranny of the womb. The tyranny of the womb. Feminist partisans, now embedded throughout the Democratic Party, authors comment, have seized medical technology and biochemistry to regulate ovaries and hormones in creating a hybrid species, females who want reproductive parity with men, while denying biological reality and dismissing the traditions of the monogamous family. We want the same freedom that men have. And we don't want the burden of the womb. The war on women is the sisterhood's war on the womb, an all-out effort to put men and women on a level playing field, and may the best man win. In hindsight, the impact of Roe versus Wade is incalculable. Listen to these statistics on abortion in the United States. From 1973 through 2008, nearly 50 million legal abortions have occurred in the United States. In 2008, 84.3% of all abortions were performed on unmarried women. What does that tell you about the morality in our country today? 84% of all abortions were performed on unmarried women. Does that not suggest that abortion is primarily a form of birth control? And, of course, Roe v. Wade made pregnancy a health emergency. It was a medical issue, and a woman's right to control her own body and to get medical help and assistance. That was somewhat the context of Roe v. Wade. Women deserve to have a choice. Well, yes, men and women should both have a choice. They do have a choice. Before you have sexual relations, you have a choice. You realize there is a possibility a child may come as a result of this encounter. Should I or shouldn't I? Well, if I'm not prepared to be a father or a mother, I shouldn't. But if I'm willing to accept that responsibility, perhaps I should, but then only within the confines and the context of marriage. But all of that, of course, is iconic. It's old. It's passed away. 84.3% of all abortions performed on unmarried women. What has happened to our country? 37% of women obtaining abortions identify themselves as Protestant. And 28% identify themselves as Catholic. In other words, 65% identify themselves as Christians, and they're getting abortions. At current rates, nearly one-third of American women will have an abortion. One-third. On average, women give at least three reasons for choosing an abortion. Three-quarters say that having a baby would interfere with work, school, or other responsibilities. When is the best time to think about that? Before you have intercourse, not after. About three-quarters also say they cannot afford a child. And one-half say they do not want to be a single parent or are having problems with their husband or their partner. Only 12% of women included a physical problem with their health among reasons for having an abortion. 12%. And 1% of aborting women reported that they were the survivors of rape. 1%. Yes, it seems that same-sex marriage has become the great equalizer in the feminist battle. And in that, they completely eliminate the father from the family portrait, other than his role as a sperm donor. State by state, Our country is moving steadily toward the acceptance of same-sex marriages. After our latest presidential election and the defeat of the Republican nominee, many within the Republican Party are encouraging party leaders to reconsider their opposition to same-sex unions. For if we're going to win an election, we have to appeal to a broader constituency. The Supreme Court will undoubtedly soon decide whether to rule on California's Proposition 8, which protects the sanctity of marriage and has been challenged in the courts on several occasions, in the lower courts, that is. Major Christian denominations are beginning to move in the same direction as described in an article that appeared in .429 magazine, which I've never heard of before, but I discovered it on the internet. In the January 6, 2011 edition, from the article, on January 1, 2011, two lesbian priests of the Episcopal Church, the very Reverend Catherine Ragsdale, dean and president of the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I'll avoid using the word R-E-V again, I'm sorry, my apologies, I'm reading from the article. They're both of that title. The other one, Mally Ewing Lloyd, canon to the ordinary in the Diocese of Massachusetts. These two women were married in Boston on January 1st, 2011. Bishop M. Thomas Shaw, the state's highest-ranking Episcopal official, presided over the ceremony. Here are some quotes from Miss Ragsdale. "We wanted to be married." This is one of the two partners, if you will. "We wanted to be married for pretty much the usual reasons. We love one another. We believe in each other. We believe we can be better together than we are alone. We want to commit to one another, to care for one another, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, and to grow old together." Well, it sounds harmless. It sounds like something anybody would want to pursue. And if there is no God, it makes no difference. But there is a God, and it does make a difference to him. Furthermore, here's what, and she is the president of the Episcopal Divinity School. Here's what she has to say about God and the Holy Spirit. "The direction of the Holy Spirit seems readily discernible to many of us. The church throughout the world is growing in the direction of inclusion and justice for all God's people." So you see, the issue is inclusion and justice. It's not what God's word teaches. It's inclusion and justice. And the direction of the Holy Spirit is discernible to her, and it's moving in that direction. "For now, the fights continue, and we," her and her mate, "are in danger of becoming the newest poster children in this ongoing fight. All of this for doing something as old-fashioned, traditional, and family-value-focused as getting married surrounded by friends and family in the church," unquote. And again, this description of same-sex marriage as completely harmless and as normal as heterosexual marriage, it is the right and the justifiable choice that people should be able to make, etc., etc. It is gaining steam. It is gaining momentum. In conclusion, this afternoon, our society and culture is changing. It's changing rapidly. Are we in the process of tearing down the old models of marriage and family and replacing them with new and improved versions that will form the foundation of a stable and prosperous future? Well, if you read Hannah Rosin, The End of Men and The Rise of Women, she would say, unequivocally yes. It's an evolutionary process. Get used to it. Live with it. It's coming. You can't stop it. Enjoy the ride, etc. Or are we tampering with God-ordained institutions and principles established at creation that will lead to the eventual demise of our nation and of our world, our culture and society as far as the human race is concerned? Notice in Isaiah chapter 4, a couple of prophetic verses before we close this afternoon. Isaiah 4. Isaiah 4, verse 12. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, those who lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. And sadly, there are women out there who feel oppressed by children and choose alternatives to rid themselves of that oppressive weight. And there are women who, in their competition with men, wish to crush them and be victorious, winning the battle. But I'm suggesting we're losing the war, and it is not going to bear good fruit. In Malachi chapter 4, I emphasized a great deal about fathers today and manhood, and we'll be balancing out the discussion here as we go through the series. But I want you to notice here in Malachi chapter 4 how important the godly figure of the father is to God. And it is something that, sadly, our society and our culture is losing sight of very, very rapidly. Verse 5 of Malachi 4, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children," something that must be done. And in that, those who would advocate a change in the role of the father are correct. The hearts of fathers should be turned to their children. There is no excuse. There is no good reason why that shouldn't be the case with all fathers. And that has not always been the case. But as in so many circumstances like this, it is a mixture of good and evil. And sadly, the evil seems to be winning in our modern culture and society. This coming Elijah will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. And that element of the social construct and the culture of the end time is so pronounced and so pointed that unless that happens at the close of this age, he will come and strike the earth with a curse, or, as is better rendered in the Hebrew, utter destruction. How important is it that we recapture a sense of fatherhood and motherhood as God designed it, of manhood and womanhood as God designed it, of husband and wife as God designed it? I'm suggesting it's very important to God. It should be very important to us. And as we witness the dramatic decline of American families and American fathers, along with fierce competition between men and women, and the resentment and or the confusion among them concerning their God-given roles and responsibilities, I would like to continue this series on biblical manhood and biblical womanhood with three more installments. Next time, we'll discuss biblical manhood, followed by the third installment, biblical womanhood. And in the final sermon, I would like to discuss men and women relating with one another in marriage, outside of marriage, on the job, wherever we encounter one another. How do we relate to one another? How do we apply these biblical principles that we will review as we look at biblical manhood and biblical womanhood? How do we apply them in the real world? And what are the benefits? What are the challenges? The series will continue on the Sabbath of December 22nd, and I will give each of these sermons on our webcast Sabbath. So I do hope, brethren, that we are aware of the importance of our God-given roles and responsibilities, and I hope that this series will be an enlightening and inspiring opportunity for us to research and explore what God has to say about this important topic.
Thank you very much, Mr. Giese. Kind of depressing, huh? Do we feel like we're kind of alone on this planet? Anyway, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Well, one of the scriptures we have, O God of every nation,